You're very welcome back to the 9 till noon show. Good morning if you've just joined us. Stay tuned because coming up after 11 o'clock, there's lots going on actually. Michael and Fionnuala return to talk That's Entertainment with us. Also, we're going to be giving away €1,000 in cash plus a €1,000 voucher to use on any celebrity cruise bookings with Atlantic Travel. How do I say this? If you are going to enter the competition, this morning's a really good time to enter. And if you want to be in with a chance to win that €10,000 plus €5,000 spending money, €10,000 travel voucher plus €5,000 spending money at the start of April, enter this morning because you are in with a really, really good chance to win not only the €1,000 plus the Celebrity Cruise Bookings €1,000 voucher, but also, of course, then you go on to be in the draw. So what are we doing here? We have a holiday of a lifetime. You can win it with Highland Radio. Thanks to our friends, or in association, sorry, with our friends at Atlantic Travel, we are giving you the chance to win a €10,000 travel voucher. Now, you can use that for multiple trips, one holiday of a lifetime. You can dip in and out of it until it's exhausted. That is yours. You'll also win €5,000 in spending money. The winner of that competition will be announced on Friday, April the 7th, right? Now, this morning, for those of you that enter early, we are having a draw at around about 11:45 for a €1,000 voucher to use on any celebrity cruise bookings with Atlantic Travel, plus €1,000 in cash. So if you're going to be entering the big draw, please enter this little draw. It's early on in the competition. Your odds are really, really quite good. Now, a ticket is €10. You can get 6 for 50 or 10 for 80. It's up to you what you want to do or how much money you have at your disposal. Completely up to you. No pressure in that regard. You can go onto our website right now and buy your tickets really simply and really securely. And you, there's a very simple question to answer. Then it's one ticket for a tenner, 6 for 50, 10 for 80. If you want to call us, we can hopefully get you sorted by giving us a call on 07491 25000. We can take your payment over the telephone. But you have just over an hour to be in with a chance to win a €1,000 voucher to use on any celebrity cruise bookings with Atlantic Travel, plus €1,000 cash for you to spend this weekend if you want. It's yours. Okay, so to be in with a chance of winning in both draws, please get your tickets in the next hour and 20 minutes, because then we do have to temporarily pause the lines until such time as we pick out the winner at 11:45. But just to remind you one more time what you're winning, and it's early on in the competition, what you could win today is a €1,000 voucher to use on any celebrity cruise bookings with Atlantic Travel, plus €1,000 in cold, hard cash. You will also automatically, of course, still be in the draw for that €10,000 travel voucher and €5,000 cash, which will be given away at the start of April. So get onto the website, highlandradio.com. Get your tickets. It could be you winning in a little over an hour and a half. And you'll be in both draws. That's the important element of it. And as I say, because we're early in this competition, chances really, really good to win that €1,000 voucher for a cruise and €1,000 in cold hard cash. All right, I just wanted to give you a good heads up on that if it's something that you want to get involved with. Right, let's read some of your comments as we head towards our next item on the programme. This is, for me, the most important part of the programme. It's what you think out there wherever you're listening to us or watching us this morning. Leo Varadkar is overstepping his mandate, saying and doing what he does. History repeating itself. War is futile. The innocent suffer and die. Wise up, Ireland. Try and get in and broker peace to save lives. Where's the so-called Green Brigade? Not worried about the pollution caused by bombs, warplanes and all weapons of war. We're leading the world to mass destruction. God help us all, they say. Leo Varadkar said yesterday, we will stop Putin. We are neutral. I'm disgusted. We are proud to be neutral and we don't want our children dying in a war that's not ours to fight. Well, you see, I mean, that's the concern, isn't it, that this is a step towards a European army, effectively, that would fight. Another caller says, if America gets involved, we'll be involved, as Shannon Airport is their stopover. And listen, I mean, the Americans are up to the oxters in this war. They are fighting Russia in Ukraine. Now, they are not on fighting it with their service people, their servicemen and women. They are fighting it with their weapons and they're fighting it with their money. War, America is involved in this war, but I do understand what you're saying in terms of Shannon stopover if they start moving troops. Another caller says, this is why we voted no on the Lisbon Treaty. We're being forced into becoming a target. The Irish people don't want this. That's why they won't give us a referendum on the issue. They know what the people think already, so they are ignoring us. And I mean, like, let's just hypothesize, right? What is, say, for instance, Russia is using Ukraine to secure Ukraine as a launch pad for something. And, you know, no one is taking Ukraine on in Ukraine. You know, could the same happen in Ireland? Could it happen in Ireland, theoretically speaking? I mean, obviously, there's the membership of different associations and what have you. But theoretically, it would be a good launch pad, wouldn't it? Another caller says it's NATO war. They started it. If President Trump was still in power, there would not be any of this nonsense going on. I'm not quite sure about that. Vladimir Putin's his own person. And he has a plan, and he's had a plan for quite some time. And the West has had their plan to try and stop his plan, and so on and so forth. And yet here we are. Another caller says, why doesn't Ireland keep out of this Waterloo? Why doesn't Ireland keep out of this war? Too small a country to be getting involved, only drawing attention to ourselves. On to housing. 90% of TDs are landlords, and that's why there is no interest in changing anything in the system. It's not 90%. I think it's around about 35 out of the 168, 9 odd. So it's not 90%. It's a significant proportion, but it's less than, I think, about 18, 15%. But then many of them might be renters as well. A caller says, I have a three-bedroomed house in the Fentown area, which I offered to the council, and they told me no one was looking for accommodation in that area. Surely if you're in need of a home, it shouldn't matter where it is. It's an interesting one. I know other people that have offered the council accommodation. Very little seems to come of it. And yet we're being told we're in this desperate, dire situation. It doesn't make sense to me. Another caller says, Leo needs to close his mouth. We're not at war. We don't want to be at war. If Leo wants to go fight, let him go. Another, I love how all we seem to hear now is the normalisation of taking property off people. We'll hear all of these big landlords hoarding property and charging massive rents, but we must remember the majority is small family homes, etc. People will think they're dealing with corrupt landlords, but really it's the small man. When you are elected, you represent the entire country, not just the area you are in, says this listener. TDs are supposed to be looking after the entire country and not just their self-interests. Another, it appears this government is not answerable to anyone. Some of the decisions they have made are just not acceptable, but they know there is no accountability. Another, taxing a spare room in your home if you rent it out. What next? Bring on an election the country's in for some shake-up. I'm just saying that could be next. At the moment, you get tax breaks for renting your room. Who's to say you won't get punished for having spare rooms? You know, that if there is that level of reach into how you can control the property market through controlling private property, could it ever be ruled out? I don't think it could ever be ruled out. A caller says, any short-term solution the government ever comes up with will never be short-term. Sadly, this is all very convenient. Housing disaster just in time for the housing referendum, hoping to delimit the right to private property. See, this is what I don't understand, right? This is actually an opposition. I must dig it out about a referendum on the right to private property, because unless I'm very much mistaken, this was a proposal from an opposition, a small opposition party, yet it's been framed as a government move. Now, unless something has changed drastically since I read up on this, it's being spread around on the internet as a government proposal. But my understanding is, I think it might have been People Before Profit they're actually proposing this. But I'll check that out. But anyway, look, there's already a great deal of government involvement in private property anyway. Maybe you're talking about the principal private residence. But I'll read this text in full, and then I'll get some clarification on who is proposing and the likelihood of our referendum. A caller says, any short-term solution the government ever comes up with will never be short-term. Sadly, this is all very convenient. Housing disaster just in time for the housing referendum, hoping to delimit the right to private property. Just think about it. Housing shortage, huge rental prices, massive influx of people, the perfect storm on the housing policy has suited property developers and not the small business person building local, or even the local council stopping people building on local property. Another, can anyone answer if the government, as the government stated, the motion on extending the eviction ban had no standing, as it was only a motion? Why then did they have to buy independence? Well, presumably how it might look if it was a defeat for government on such a matter. On a opposition opposition proposal, because the vote eventually was on a government amended motion, wasn't it? Morning, Greg. Why don't the council start buying up properties in Donegal? Donegal town have a lot of potential development opportunities in the towns itself. I think that's what the government want them to do. Where are they going to get the money? Are they funded to do it? Do they have the staff? Why? And also, to what does that do for the property market? Does it send house prices skyrocketing? Do they stay as they are, or do they drop? I don't know. Why is no one talking about the derelict houses? A property tax on these derelict houses? There are five within walking distance from my house, says a listener. It shouldn't make a difference if someone refuses a house. If it doesn't suit them, someone else will take it. I don't see the harm. Okay, and that's the point Michael McLafferty was making. I respect that. How would overtaxing Airbnb help our tourism? That is the biggest employer in Donegal, and many people rent holiday homes as their only income. As a disabled person unable to work, I'm hoping to rent to tourists. I don't want to long-term rent, as I would have all sorts of problems. Greg, when you elect 27 TDs who are landlords, do you expect them to want to reduce their income when they can do what they are doing, preserving high rents and now being able to make human beings, real children, babies, older people and the most vulnerable live on the streets? Another, the only solution is the government needs to start building, even if it's prefab homes, but councils won't allow planning for lots of them. Local authority building on government land is the only way, but it takes profit away from developers and reduces house prices and rents, which affects the government's buddies. And on they come. They continue to come in. Thank you very much for it. Really appreciated. 086 60 25,000 WhatsApps and texts to that number. Right, OK, there is a new book out from a leading psychotherapist, Stella O'Malley, and it is entitled What Your Teen Is Trying to Tell You. I think there's times that anyone with children might ask themselves that question. That's if they speak at all, but that in and of itself may be an indication of something. Any questions about your teens? Now, onto the show is the author of What Your Teen Is Trying to Tell You. It's Stella O'Malley, and she is a leading psychotherapist. Thanks so much for joining us, Stella. Great to have you on the program.
Thank you.
And it's an interesting book because I think the overwhelming majority of parents and guardians, grandparents, aunts and uncles, whomever, who might have a role in the raising of a child and as they hit the teenage years, might often ask themselves, what is that teen trying to tell you? And sometimes they maybe are telling you by not saying anything at all. It's a tough old age, and I suppose it can be tough to deal with too, and to do the right thing.
Yeah, I think it's very hard to be a teenager these days. An awful lot of childhood is very magical and it's very pleasant. And, you know, children are told their dreams will come true. And, you know, if they just try hard enough, they'll win. And then they reach adolescence and they get a kind of a very sharp shock of reality when they realise actually it's much harder than that. Life is very difficult and it's often unfair and you can try very hard and still lose. And so I think that dawning of realisation hits them very hard.
Is it more difficult now than before? Because, you know, we're all talking about what we should be telling our teenagers, what we shouldn't be telling them, how we should be guiding them or not letting them decide what they want to be. I welcomed when I was a young person, you know, a hand on my shoulder advising me where I need to go or should go and the realities of life and the pitfalls of life. It seems now the policy is that just let them at it, let them be what they want to be, let them feel what they want to feel. But it's not really working, given recent statistics in terms of mental health and what have you. Are we sure, as a society, giving them the right, we're raising them and allowing them to mature in the right sort of space as a society?
I don't think we're doing very well with adolescents at the moment. There's an awful lot of mental health problems and they do need guidance. They do need the kind of the wise words and they're not getting them. There's been an awful lot of disempowerment of parents and there's been an awful lot of impact from social media. And it's as a result, an awful lot of teenagers feel anxious and not sure of themselves. And I don't think we're getting it right. I do think we need to get kind of have more authority. Now, I'm not saying be strict disciplinarians, but certainly there's it feels a bit chaotic and as if they're leading the way and they're very unsure of themselves, even though they seem cocky They're very unsure of themselves. It's a very scary and burdensome thing to be told you're in charge when you're a teenager.
And it also is very dependent on which teenager you're talking of, you know, and what their behaviour and how they speak really is reflecting what's going on within them.
Yeah, they say about a third of teenagers like sail through, about a third have choppy enough times, but ultimately they're okay, and about a third have a really, really rough time. And, you know, and most mental health issues emerge first during adolescence. So some of those are going to be very serious problems.
Like just going early on, I mean, there was a story recently, and I'm not a shock jock, by the way, and you might not be familiar with the show, but just so that's not really my style, right? But there was a recent high profile case, of course, and this is about much younger than teenage years, but I think it might set a tone for the rest of someone's life. That we had a high-profile politician and his partner recently had a child. They didn't assign it a gender. They gave it a gender-neutral name with the view that it will discover as it matures what it wants to be. It doesn't want to be it. I found it quite insulting as a man and maybe some as a woman. This is the only part of it whereby having assigned gender is a disadvantage. I personally don't believe that's the case. I think everyone's entitled to feel what they want to feel, but I don't want to get into a space where actually it's hold you back because you happen to be born and identified from birth as a male. But anyway, be that as it may, would you have a concern as a psychotherapist putting that much pressure, or is it seen as pressure or weight, on a child to sort of even find out something as fundamental as that through the journey of life from a young age? I mean, if we're starting that with babies and toddlers, and it kind of seemingly now continues into teenage years, it just sounds to me like it puts an awful lot of pressure on a child that simply does not know.
I think you're right. I think we've moved from being child-centred to child-led, and I think that's actually a very heavy burden on a child's shoulders. You know, one of the kind of great gifts of childhood and adolescence is the freedom not to have these burdens on you, that the adults are in charge and the adults are making decisions. For example, where we live, what school we go to. And the child and the teenager, they might have input. Certainly, you can listen to what they're saying. But the idea that they are actually making the definitive decision is too much of a burden on their shoulders. It weighs heavily. And like most kids will take it and they'll say, oh, yeah, I'll have this. I love being in charge, but are immature, so they think it's great, but sure, that's the entire concept of being a child. Just because you want to be in charge doesn't mean you get to be in charge, and the adults should be shouldering the responsibility of leading the way and offering guidance. And I agree with you. I think you can be anything as a boy and you can be anything as a girl, and I don't think you need to change anything about that, other than society maybe needs to free us up so that, you know, boys could wear dresses or whatever. That we don't need to play around with pronouns to do that. We have the freedom to live as we wish.
Like I'm thinking of the women's Six Nations team lining up this weekend, or Katie Taylor is going, right, so, you know, I was disadvantaged right from the get-go. Do you know what I mean? I'm not having a go at that. Everyone's entitled to do what they want to do. I'm not in any way encroaching on in that, okay? But there's a normalisation, or at least an attempt to normalise certain stuff. My only interest in, it doesn't matter for me anymore, is children. And I just want to make sure that whatever we are doing is best for children of all ages, up until the age of 17 or 18, that we are tooling and equipping them for half the awful realities of life that hit you like a wrecking ball when you go to third level or even into big school. Do you know what I mean? And I just don't, it just feels like a space where it's supposed to be about protecting and nurturing children, but it seems we're moving away from that. We're relinquishing that responsibility almost.
Under a cloak of I'm just listening to the child. But, you know, the freedom of being a child is the freedom to be able to make mistakes and for the adults to step in for the more serious kind of, you know, decisions.
Because the whole thing, I'm holding a book here, which we're going to talk about now, which is educating big, hairy adults, right, on how to look after the teenagers. And yet there are some subscribing saying that children should be able to do it all themselves. You know what I mean? Yet we need this book. We need this book for the adults, for the grown-ups. Do you know what I mean? So let's get to the book, Stella. Because it's a tough one. Do you know what I mean? Dealing with teenagers. And I find, you know, I find like I'm being influenced by stuff now. So I want to help I want to be disciplined. You know, I'd want to be disciplined with teenagers and all, but I'm so afraid now to say the wrong thing in case it damages their mental health. And then I feel like I need to keep checking the bedroom door to make sure everything's in there. Like, I think we're full of fear and disempowerment now as adults that we might be doing them harm or they might harm themselves if we do or say the wrong thing or are too strict. Does this book help us with working all that out?
Yeah, I actually talk specifically about that exact point in the book, which is that an awful lot of parents feel frozen in the face of their child or their teenager's mental distress because there's been such heavy messages about mental health that once the teenager's in distress, parents are afraid. They can fold like paper. They're afraid to hold authority because they're like, oh, they'll have mental health issues. And that's a very unfortunate byproduct of the mental health kind of industry that has left parents kind of disempowered and afraid to upset their kid, when actually, you know, between, you know, 10 and 20, children are pushing boundaries and parents are holding boundaries. That's what should be happening. There should be a lot of conflict because they're pushing against them and we're holding the authority. And if we're afraid of our children's tears and we're afraid of our children's distress, we're not going to give them the authority that they need. Now, I know this is complicated because I know, obviously, mental health is a huge issue. I'm a psychotherapist. I'm very, very interested in well-being. But I think it's a very unfortunate new development that so many parents are afraid of upsetting their kid. And so they're often asking me, you know, how do we, for example, parents that I work with might say, you know, how do I hold this line without having a fight? And I'm like, oh, no, you're going to have a fight. Mm. There's going to be many fights. And they're slightly horrified by that because they think they'll be able to do it without a fight. And I'm like, I'm not convinced you will. Now, it doesn't have to be a rip-roaring brawl, but there will be, you know, rolled eyes, slammed doors, as there has been for thousands of years.
You will see in the wild, you'll see a tiger cub at some point snap at the mother.
Yeah.
And it will have to be reprimanded for it. And then, you know what I mean? There's a lot of this that we're born with. It's within us. It's not just humans, it's animals, right? So I think the book starts off chapter one, understanding the teenage minds. They're half adult, half child. Why are they irrational? What's going on in their head? That introduces us really to a better understanding of, because we can forget, can't we? And we can look back with rose-tinted glasses, what it's like to be a teenager, how the mind is developing, what's happening there. And then you move on to connecting and communicating with your team, which is, again, some people really, really struggle with that. It can be difficult because some parents want to be their children's best friends, you know, and I'm not really quite sure that works very well, because then when it comes to saying you can't do this or you can't do that, it's all very complicated. So I think going through those processes there maybe can help you find the right balance through those two chapters.
Yeah, I think, you know, if a child is lucky enough to have parents that they are the only, those two parents are the only two parents in the world of that child. It's a very, very special relationship. You can have 1,000 friends, you can only really have two parents. And so it's really, really important that it's treasured and appreciated for its special role. And that special role is to give long-term guidance and to give authority. But yeah, that first chapter talks about the kind of, if you're aware of the biology or the neuroscience of the teenage brain, you realize they're literally playing with half a deck compared to adults. Their brain isn't fully formed, and it won't be fully formed until they're in their kind of early 20s. So it's like a kind of a snow globe. It's all full of chaos, and it's, you know, and it will settle, but it hasn't settled. And some parts of the brain, of the teenage brain, like the emotional part, is very overdeveloped. And the wise, reasonable, genuine, it's actually neuroscience, isn't yet developed. So their ability to be wise and reasonable is not there. They don't have it yet. And they will have it. It'll come. But right now they're filled with emotion and certainty, and we adults need to just accept that that is who they are. It's almost like we accept the toddlers have to go through developmental tasks, like learning how to, you know, ride a bike or you know, tie their laces, whatever they're doing. Then in teenage years, they also have developmental tasks such as learning how to cope with distress, learning how to manage difficult relationships, learning how to regulate their emotions. Mm. All those tasks need to be kind of tackled and also kind of overcome to become a fully functioning adult. And it takes some time. And I think we forget that they have developmental milestones just like a child. It's just the more complicated ones. So I go through that in the book.
Yeah. And dealing with the common issues, of course, like anxiety, obsession with technology, body confidence too, I think. How do you best support and how do you articulate that support? You know, I think every child's going to, every teenager is going to come across some of those issues through their teenage years, and we're empowered then, presumably, to best support and help them and understand them.
Yeah, I think never before has there been so much emphasis on looks. And teenagers have always been vain because their bodies are changing so fast and, you know, the hormones are coming in. But these days, the emphasis on looks is just phenomenal. And, you know, all the pictures, all the selfies, all the kind of various different aspects of their looks, it's really, really a difficult challenge for teenagers to navigate constant emphasis on your looks and pictures and things like that.
What I think is also an interesting one here is, because this is almost like the flip side, why doesn't my teen want to grow up? I kind of got a little chuckle when I read that, because some teenagers they're dreading starting 17 or 18, and presumably that forms part of this too, this chapter.
It is. It's a real issue. It's more of an issue than it has been before. Usually teenagers do want to grow up. When I say usually, in previous generations, teenagers wanted to grow up because they'd get more freedom. There was very definite benefits to growing up. An awful lot of teenagers these days, they don't want to grow up. They want to remain childlike. Growing up feels full of admin, full of burdens, and not really much fun. And so we adults, we kind of owe it to children to sell adulthood to them so that they do want to grow up, because it's a terrible thing that there's a kind of concept called failure to launch, where there's an awful lot of people in their 20s, they haven't moved out of their childhood home. They're still in their childhood bedroom. They're not interested in growing up. They're not interested in getting a job. And their parents their hearts are scalded. They don't know what to do about these kids. Mm. So it's a very serious issue. This is the first generation of children that can't expect to have as much wealth as their parents. And they don't expect to have houses as wealthy as their parents. It's a huge new development that has never happened before, because every other generation until now presumed that they would do better than their parents. They didn't always, mm-hmm. but they presumed that they would. Mm. And this generation don't think that. And that's strange.
Just in relation to the book, like I don't want to frame it incorrectly, and you correct me if I'm wrong, of course. I don't see this as a book that someone necessarily might read between, you know, in the last week of someone in their 12th year and then put it on eBay, right? The way it seems to be set up to me is that the various issues are covered in as many or as few new words that are required. So in other words, if a parent has this on a bookshelf and they're concerned that, you know, someone's spending too much time in front of the mirror or on a phone, or are they anxious, or are they just feeling anxious? Do they have anxiety, or are they in an anxious moment, that you can jump to that section? Yeah. And just feel a bit empowered with some words that maybe actually just affirm what you're already feeling.
Yeah, the idea of the book, you've got it right, is to dip in and dip out as the issues. Now, you could read it through if you were so inclined, but it would be certainly written so that you can dip into the specific issues that's on your mind about your teenager. Because I think parents do feel disempowered, and they'll feel more settled when they read something like, okay, I've got this, I can handle this. I don't have to charge off to the professionals. It's just a few words around any given topic to give a kind of psychological understanding of what might be going on for the teenager.
Yeah, and as I say, I might be coming across as enthusiastic. It's just it kind of appeals to me in that I think we have a really important role in helping and guiding our teenagers, and we shouldn't be ashamed or embarrassed or whatever out of doing that. You know, there are times in my life when I remember going to my mother, and just for a really brief chat. And I needed what she had to say to me to make me feel better. Do you know what I mean? I couldn't have done it. I couldn't have felt like I could done it, do it on my own. Yet modern thinking would probably be for her to say to me, look, son, whatever. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's a weird kind of cloak where they're saying basically to the kids and teenagers, you've got this. And the teenagers are like you, kind of would like some words of guidance. But
well, I've got it if TikTok is what life is. If TikTok's my parents, I've got it. Yeah, of course I do. But I mean, if the real world... It's not, that isn't the way it is. So I don't got it because you're not born with this knowledge. You're not born with this decision-making power. You're not born to understand the various things that can happen in your body through, you know, the ages of 9, 10, 11, 12, 13. Aquila says, my daughter's been diagnosed with non-epileptic attack disorder, pseudo-seizures, finding it so difficult to cope with. Is there any advice on this that you could give how this parent might be able to deal with their young person?
Yeah, I think that young person could be helped in many different ways. Certainly, there could be kind of a lot of help around anxiety with that child. I think she would benefit from, you know, maybe going to therapy, but certainly, and I don't charge off to therapy every teenager, but that's quite serious what that kid is confronting. There's a brilliant book, and it's not my book, but it's about exactly those seizures called It's All in Your Mind. It's by Suzanne O'Sullivan. An amazing book. I really recommend that parent not only buys my book, but buys that one.
Okay, and we can get both at a discount. Hey, why not? Listen, Camille, I really appreciate your time this morning, obviously, because it's such a complex matter. We can only sort of brush across it, but I hope people get a feel for what we're talking about. The book is What Your Teen Is Trying to Tell You. It's by Stella O'Malley. As I say, you could read it. I think maybe definitely read chapters one or two, and then sure you can dip in and out as the inevitable problems arise.
Yeah,
my word, no one's got a teenager through their teenage years without issues. There's just no doubt about that. And it's normal. It's part of our development, you know, as it is. We can't avoid it. We have to deal with this. Say, for instance, a teenager has lost a grandparent that they're very close to. That's really difficult. It can be the first sort of sense of bereavement and what have you. Things like that are covered in the book as well, because we can feel really, what do we do? What do we say? Right, okay, listen, I really appreciate your time this morning. I've enjoyed talking to you and continued success. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much.
Have a lovely day, okay? That is leading psychotherapist Stella O'Malley. Any views on anything we were talking about there? 086 60 25000, 086 60 25000. That's your WhatsApps and texts, or give us a call on 07491 25000. We were talking earlier on about housing, and I brought up the issue of the last group of stats I saw, that one third of social homes that have been offered are refused. Now, this is not me saying this, I'm quoting the statistics, but in the past there have been councillors that have been interviewed on this programme and in newspapers that have stated that there should be checks and balances in place, that if someone were to refuse a house a certain amount of time, that such and such would have happened. So this is an issue that's been debated in the chamber of the council. Now, we heard from Michael McClafferty, and many agreeing with him, that the house isn't disappearing because someone refuses it. It's still there. Someone will get it, so there's no harm in it. Sinead joins us now. Sinead, where within all of that do you sit in relation to the provision and providing and offering of social housing?
Well, thanks for asking me on first. But yeah, I would pretty much agree with Michael. I don't, you know, the houses are there. The houses are not going, you know, if someone refuses a social housing house, then someone else will take that house. I just wouldn't want to be in a space where we are taking people off of social housing, perhaps the people who need it the most. And I was given the example of, well, look, what if that's a single parent? What if that's a single parent with children who their entire support network is in that particular area, and they have no access to cars or, you know, or transport or things like that.
The only thing, Sinead, is we do have access to the reasons as to why people refuse social housing. And You know, okay. that's the obvious, you know, I don't think anyone would want anyone to have to uproot and lose that structure. But sometimes people refuse houses because they've got a motorbike and there's nowhere to put it. So, and again, that's probably another extreme example. So I want to avoid that and put it to you like this, Sinead.
Yeah.
Should we then separate those out that refuse it for very real reasons like you've just outlined, compared to someone who refuses it for reasons that perhaps might seem unreasonable, then would that help to make it a fairer system then? Because it might, that person you talk of might get a house quicker.
But how are we going to police that though, Greg? Who's going to police that? Mm-hmm. Who's going to have the staff to police that? Who's going to be paying for that policing of that? Does for instance, Donegal County Council, do they have the ability to do that? So if we're going to separate out reasons as to why someone refuses house, you know, and I know what's going to happen is that, you know, if you're allowed to refuse a house for a particular reason, everybody's going to say it's for that reason. So that's not going to work. The solution to this is to build social housing. I've been saying it, a lot of us have been saying it for years and years and years. And unfortunately, we've had Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil in power. And it hasn't been happening. So that's what it is. They need to build social housing. They need to build social housing in areas where they're needed. And that's going to be the solution to this. Nobody's going to be able to police that. Nobody.
Yeah, but I mean, if you're on the waiting list, you're desperate for housing. We're in a housing crisis. You know, we've got far more mm-hmm. people that need houses than houses that are available. Do all those rules that you say still apply in this situation?
What rules do you like mean now?
In terms of, you know, it's okay to refuse a house and what have you. Do you know what I mean? Like, we are desperate here. And then, of course, because people may be being fussy, as some might describe it, we've got people that are out of this scheme altogether because they're on really quite low wages. And maybe if people weren't as fussy, the scheme could be widened out. I'm only saying this to tease out the conversation, Sinead, and hope I'm being clear.
Yeah.
But,
no,
you know,
with everything
that's ongoing, can we afford to be picky? Even if it is maybe moving another 5 miles away from your sister or your auntie or your mother or your dad or your uncle. Do you know what I mean? Or even moving the children to another school. You know, in a crisis, is that excuse enough?
I've seen some of the reasons, you know, that people have given. And my own personal opinion on that is, look, that's not reasonable, right? But if we try to implement a system where people are being refused for, and you're only allowed to refuse for certain reasons, and look, there are many examples of good reasons as to why people should be allowed to, why they have to stay in their own area. The example I gave earlier on, what if that woman, and I know it's not just women, but it's primarily women, suffering from domestic abuse, they've got an abusive partner, they've left them, they need to be within 5 minutes of their family. They need that for their sense of security. Mm-hmm. They need to feel safe. So if we're going to have a system where people are after a certain cutoff point, that's it. You're not allowed to. Are we going to say that those people and, you know, should be living terrified in fear all the time? Or, you know, is that what we're saying?
Yeah.
I just don't see how it's workable.
No, you make a very strong point, Sinead, and really talks to the complexity of the problem that we have. You know, and I don't think anyone would want anyone to be placed in danger or to feel in danger, as you've outlined. I don't think anyone would. All right, Sinead, as you say, we just need more houses in the right place, I suppose. Thanks for your time today.
More houses and more portable houses as well. They need to get their act together.
That does not seem to be a Donegal solution for some reason.
Well, that's a choice. That's a choice. That's
okay.
All I'll say. It is workable.
Morning, Sinead. Take care of yourself. I appreciate it. Hi, Greg. Totally agree with most of your listeners. Leo Varadkar has no right in making decisions in supporting the war in Ukraine against the wishes of the majority of the Irish people. But we don't know if it's against the wishes of the majority of Irish people. We have not been consulted on this, by the way. That's your view. And then Leo Varadkar is expressing his view. Now, the problem is that the listener that sent this in is not the leader of the government. But anyway, reading on, like what I'm saying is I don't like to presume that the majority of the Irish people oppose what Leo Varadkar said either, because I don't think that helps us. I'll read the comment in full. Hi, Greg. Totally agree with most of your listeners. Leo Varadkar has no right in making decisions in supporting the war in Ukraine against the wishes of the majority of the Irish people. We are a neutral, small country. They should be working towards peace. Look what America and Britain did in Iraq. Lied and totally destroyed that country and gave rise to ISIS and the loss of thousands of innocent people and children's lives. NATO and America need to start talking peace for everyone's sake. They would say, though, that if they do not pin back Putin where he's at, that the world as we know it could change. So that's what their argument is. A caller says it's great that the only DUP members publicly opposing the Windsor framework are the ones that carry on getting big money as MPs. If Stormont falls, remind me of union bosses calling strike action while they still get full pay and the workers get nothing when on strike. Another caller says the only way to sort out any crisis in Ireland is for the people to stand together and demand an action immediately. A child can see the current government has no confidence. They're running the country into the ground because they know Sinn Féin are going to be elected next time round. So they're putting the country into red so the next party elected can't do anything. Stand together peacefully, protest and get the current government out. Again, let me just point out too, if you don't mind, that if even in the opinion polls, the current government has 45% of the vote as things are. And no one should presume that there's going to be a complete wipeout in the next general election, because those percentages actually also don't necessarily relate to seats. So it's just important for absolute balance here that the current government enjoys 45% support-ish there or thereabouts. If you throw in the independents there, you could probably push it towards 45, 46. I don't have the exact stats. But anyway, I think sometimes we presume that no one supports the government, that what the government is, everything they're doing is wrong. That's not the case. Lots of people, as I say, almost half the population, actually, really, when you look at it, support this current coalition. So that shouldn't be ignored, and nothing should be presumed either, I don't think.